And we're live with our 318th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. I am having, I don't know if it's imposter syndrome or questioning my identity today. After the last week, if you happen to be in Slack recently, you will know why. We're going to get into a discussion about that here shortly. Otherwise, right, a couple of things. We just got back from KernelCon. I'm repping the hoodie here today and had a great harnessing LLMs, agentic AI course, right? There's quite a bit there to actually dig into, and the new deep agent stuff is amazing. I will just tell you that. And anyway, had a really good time at KernelCon, and then we do have a couple of opportunities coming up soon over the course of the next couple weeks, and then over the summer as well. So first up is DEF CON Singapore. That class is selling out. We just had to up the number of seats available, right? They pushed us into a different room because we've had so many people sign up, but there are still a couple of seats available for that course. If you're going to be at Singapore, that's a great place to actually, you know, get in and get your hands dirty with agentic AppSec things. Besides that, we will be at Hacker Summer Camp, both Black Hat, which will be a combination course, the secure code review plus the agentic or the AI enhanced AppSec, and then DEF CON will be teaching there again, agentic AppSec harnessing LLMs. So there's going to be opportunities to take these trainings. If there is interest, for an online course, Ken and I have talked about that as well, and actually pushing through another online version of either practical secure code review or harnessing LLMs. So reach out. I haven't updated the site yet, but watchtraining.absoluteappsec.com, or I'd say join Slack, but we're going to get into why that's a little bit more difficult here shortly. I think that's about it outside of, you know, travel coming up for, you know, getting to Singapore is always an interesting couple of days of travel. Anywhere else that you're going to be, Ken? Any other conferences that you got on top of mind before we launch into the saga of being the target of phishing, whatever?
Yeah, you and I are doing something next month. Actually, well, in exactly 1 month from now, I believe it's May 14th at an event. Cole Cornford and Gala Cyber are putting, I think they're the ones putting it on, or one of the folks putting it on. Is that a panel? I think it's a panel, right? With us and
it's a panel. Folks. Yep. It doesn't look like. It's in Santa Clara, right? If I remember right. Let's see if I can find the link for that. Yes, San Francisco Secure Software and AppSec Summit. Here I've got the. I've got to pull the link here. It says San Francisco, but it is in Palo Alto. So, you know, yeah. I'm going to post it. Yeah, I'll post it here.
And then... So, like, whatever. I'll just Uber to wherever I got to go.
Yeah, I know. Really... Yeah, so it's down in Santa Clara.
It's just California. You know?
It's just California.
I don't know the nuances. I'm just like, well, there's the north part and there's the south part.
South part, yeah. North
part. Oh, is it south part or north part? It's north part, right?
It's the north part. Yeah. You're going to be flying into SFO. Yes. You'll be flying into SFO.
I'll book a flight for San Diego right now. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically the same place, you know. All right. Yeah. Should be good, right? Like, yeah, you know, we're up there. Cole, and it's Clutch Events. I mean, we attended some Clutch Events stuff down in Australia a couple of years ago, right? When we were doing the training down there as well. That was also good. So it'll be an interesting mix to be sure of different people that are going to be speaking and available. Yeah, looks like Daniel Meisler's going to be there. Awesome. Yeah.
There's some addicts, I think, people. Too, and a few.
Yeah.
A few others. Yep. Cool. Yeah, it's going to be like Clint Gibbler. Should be good.
Yep, it'll be good. Ben, Patrick. Cool. Well, speaking of our, you know, our Australian listeners, right? What morning was this? This was that Friday? Dang, I can't even remember at this point.
Yeah, that's a good point. I thought it was, for some reason, I thought I was like, I know it was Friday morning, Eastern time, because I was coming off an airplane and I was getting messages about this. And I was in an Uber on the way home getting messages about this. And that's why I remember, because I came off a red eye from Omaha. I think, didn't I come off from Omaha?
Yeah, it was Thursday morning at about 6 a.m. our time, right?
Thursday morning. Yeah, I'm sorry, man. It's all jumbled
in my brain. Same. Because I was in Omaha, right? Like, and it was fairly obvious that we were. So basically what happened is people were getting messages on Slack, supposedly from me, about like a long message about an AI project that I was working on. And here's a link. Will you go review this document and help me actually flush out what's going on with it? It was obvious it was a malware attempt, right? Somebody was trying to install malware. And it was not me. So they had logged in, they had registered with Slack probably about a week before, just through one of our invite links, because we're fairly open about that. And had then tried to, here, let me see if I can post this image. Yeah. Yeah, it was basically like, could you help with test with something? Let me see if I can download this quick. Because I mean, I didn't see it. They obviously didn't do it to me, because I would have known it's not myself, right? But you can go back through.
They didn't send to me either.
Yeah, so they were pretty intelligent about it, to be honest, right? Let's see, image file, here we go. Yeah, so this was the message, right? I'm not sure how well you can actually read that, right? Yeah. Oh, they had a sites.google.com link, right, that people could sign into. And they used that as a redirect, basically, right, to actually push that malware down. That's what was happening there. And then wherever they were pulling the malware down got taken down pretty quickly. And then it turns out, like, I mean, our Australian listeners, those that they actually got pinged with it, the discussion started about 6 a.m. if you go watch. That it was not actually me, was somebody else that had just changed their username to be the same as mine, changed their image to look exactly like me, and was attempting to basically take advantage of the community and run a malware campaign, get things installed. But I was really, it was really a quick turnaround, to be honest, right? In how quickly the community responded, right? Yeah.
Just like instantaneously, basically.
Yeah. What are you going to say? Sorry.
Well, just because, like, one thing I don't know if we've really been made clear is that we weren't the only ones attacked, right? Like, Linux Foundation, it was attacked. This was an attack on open source Slack communities in general, not just Absolute AppSec. This is part of a wider set of attacks that went after popular communities, really. That's what it is. And thankfully, you know, due to you all, we've built a pretty popular community and we're on that list. The good news for us and the bad news for the attackers is that, you know, our folks are security people. So they're very security minded. They reached out immediately. We took actions immediately. But these other groups, these aren't security minded groups. And honestly, if I read your message and I was in another group like that, who's to say if they would actually catch it? You know what I mean? Like, I actually think it'd be pretty, in a different Slack, it might actually be pretty effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it got shut down pretty quickly. I mean, and we're all naturally a little suspicious, right? I, you know, My favorite response was probably from Andrew, and he's like, why is Seth pinging me so early in the morning with some dumb inane stuff, right? Like, that was his first, right, like, response. I was like, yeah, fair enough, right? Like, most of the US people are probably like, what the hell, Seth? Yeah, Bobby was stoked, right? Like, is he saying, to collab on a project? Bobby, we can choose something else, I promise, brother. Yeah, it was interesting, right? Like, for me, it was, I don't know, it felt pretty surreal that it was me they were trying to, you know, impersonate, really, because I was like, really? That's my imposter syndrome coming out. I was like, really? Like, I'm the one that you picked, right? Like, but we're chatty in Slack, right? Like, we share a lot of ideas, we share a lot of articles and other things. So I guess, whatever, right? I guess, whatever. I don't know. Anything else you want to say about that? Hold on, let me grab the links from, right, Open SSF, Software Security Foundation. Yeah.
Yeah, I do want to say something. Mm-hmm. Slack, why?
Oh, yes.
Why would you think that's okay? Why could we have two different users that look exactly the same? Like, that's my only, like, I don't understand why that's, did we learn nothing from Git impersonation? Like, really?
Apparently not.
It's so ridiculously silly. I mean, and in case anybody's not sure what I'm saying, like, if you ever, like, change your Git protocol, change your email when you go to do, like, a Git commit to somebody else's email on GitHub, it'll allow you to look like that person. It's not a fault of GitHub. It's the Git protocol itself. There are no controls. It is directly taking client-side user-supplied input and deciding what avatar and what username to show based off the details you put into your Git commit message, right? That is why we have GPG signing on GitHub. I don't know about GitLab or the other providers, but that's why they have GPG signing, is so that you can actually attest to, yeah, it's not only who I say I am, but I'm actually proving, you know, cryptographically I am who I say I am, because there are just no, like, Git protocol built-ins to help there, right? That's just the way it works. So I can kind of understand that, where it's like, oh, we built something on a protocol and, like, you know, we have to build additional controls in. But I cannot understand that with Slack. That's fairly unforgivable. You shouldn't have username collisions like that. You shouldn't be able to so easily spoof somebody. So if anything, I would like to see Slack's, and if anybody on this, speaking of Slack, if anybody on this Slack knows or works with anybody at Slack, please, please point them at us, point them at this podcast, point them at, just let them know we're, like, I don't know, get the word out. We'd like to talk to somebody and figure out if there's a way to, like, this could be a good moment for the community to take some serious action on this, because this is really bad. That's really frustrating to me that's even possible. You know, I didn't know until that attack this was possible. So I wouldn't have thought it. I wouldn't have never thought that.
Yeah, I wouldn't either, right? Like, when I started looking into it, because my first thought was like, oh, there's got to be a flag, like, that doesn't allow for username impersonation, right? Like, I can't change my username to somebody else's. And that's not even a control that exists. I think that Slack and Salesforce, because Salesforce owns Slack now, right? That their model is to target organizations that control users via another mechanism, to Bobby's point, right? Big corporations have IDPs, and that's where they pull usernames from. And so Slack, in their inherent wisdom, have decided that it's not an issue that they are concerned about. But I would like to see controls like that, even in the cases of free workspaces or other things, so that we could actually control it. I mean, otherwise, we're going to be forced to create some sort of a hook or an app that actually does the check every time somebody changes their username, or we're auditing that constantly, right?
Yeah, here's your answer. CEO doesn't care, by the way. Here's an article from 2018. Doesn't care. Not going to revert to usernames. Maybe I am skimming for the podcast. I shouldn't be so, like, I'll dial this back and say, I haven't read this entire article, but from first glance and the Twitter responses from the CEO, it did look like they just really honestly didn't care at all. This isn't the priority. They believe that if you're in Slack, you're already trusted. It seems like that was his response. But again, this is 2018. I'm skimming. But yeah, anyways, I don't want to beat up on Slack too bad, but like I kind of do also, because this does need to be fixed. This can't be like a thing that, because just so you know, like for the people listening, we're at a moment now where we used to be able to just post that invitation link on our website. Anybody could sign up and they could join the community. And until they do something obnoxious, they would be able to continue, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I say obnoxious, you know, we've only had a couple instances where people try to sell stuff on our Slack or try to heavily promote themselves or whatever, just kind of like be obnoxious in that way, but not in a, this is the first time we've been maliciously attacked. So in any case, it's not okay. Like I'd like to be able to put that invite link back out there. I had to manually do email invites to people. I don't know how much I like personally, I'm a very big, if you can only imagine what the life of a CTO is like, slash co-founder of a software security startup in this space. I don't have a lot of time to be emailing people invite links. So please Slack, this is the last time I'll say it, reach out. Please reach out. So yeah, connect.
Yeah. So with that though, if you do need a Slack invite, you probably could hit us, you know, hit me and Ken up at absoluteappsec.com and we will send that to you. We are still willing to give those out. It's probably just not going to be quite as open as it was in the past until we can figure out a different solution for this sort of abuse, right? Since Slack is obviously not the ones that are going to be doing anything about it. Cool. I guess cool, right? So what else do you want to talk about today? Do you want to talk about KernelCon, the experience there? I know like...
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Yeah, this is kind of why a lot of communities move to Discord. Yeah. True. I don't know if that's something like... We would have to talk to the community on whether or not this is something that we'd want to entertain, right? Just the ability to, you know, greater control. Slack was kind of the easy button for us as we were starting the podcast, and it's worked fairly well up until now. So we can start a wider discussion, especially if community members, hint, hint, are willing to step in and help us administer things, right? Yeah.
Oh, that's a good point. I'd be willing to give out free swag for mods for sure. Mm-hmm. Like we got some, check out our swag store. Got some pretty good merch. I'm sure we could hook you up with something if you want to, and probably even like occasionally, you know, I get like extra, you and I get like extra tickets to things and stuff like that. So no promises, but I'm sure we could throw some stuff your way for sure if people want to volunteer. But no, I don't know what else to say on this one. It really upsets me that that's even like a thing that's possible. It's just way too easy to social engineer people. And I am grateful for our community and I'm grateful for everybody that reached out. I got hit up with Seth. Obviously, they couldn't reach out directly to you. So I got a lot of messages. I got text messages. I got Signal messages. I got Slack messages. I got all the messages. I think I maybe even got an email. I'm not sure. I don't know. I got a lot of messages and maybe even a DM on LinkedIn, believe it or not. So anyways, point is like the community did a great job. We're really appreciative of you all. You're all really great. And thank you for letting us know. And Slack, get your shit together. And I will try to not be too mean, but... somebody please reach out because I don't want to have to like make a blog post on why I'm upset with Slack. That would suck. Mm-hmm. So let's not do that.
Yes. Let's not do that. I'd imagine there's going to be a little bit more pressure, especially where it wasn't just us that was targeted, but there were other large software development and open source communities that were hit. I mean, just the fact that it was on Open Software Security Foundation, the OpenSSF group and their mailing list means there should be more going on. So watch this space. We will track it, right? Just to see what the response will be. Okay, so KernelCon. What are your thoughts on KernelCon this year?
Okay, let me preface. Seth was there during the actual conference. I was there just only during the training days. I had too much to do, et cetera, et cetera. So here's what I can say, just logistic wise. So it was at the Embassy Suites down in Omaha. For most of you, this won't matter. But what I'm going to say is that what actually matters is that so there was a venue change between Embassy Suites to like, I don't know what, like a mile down the road or less to the Hilton. I think I liked ultimately that move to the Hilton because of the conference layout space. There was more, there was just more space. There's more room. And that's to the next point, which is that I talked to Adam Shaw, primary organizer of KernelCon. And I think he also does LocomocoSec and whatever, but we always spend time with Adam while we're out there. We spent some time with him asking him questions about the conference. And I think it was like 100+ X person increase between that last year and this year. And that just keeps sort of exponential thing. Like, I don't know how many years in a row, but maybe this is their fifth or sixth or something like that year. It's just growing and growing, and growing. So they did outgrow the last venue. And to that end, the, like in terms of what that allows them to do at that size of a conference, is it's starting to feel a little bit to me more like it's moving towards a DerbyCon style-ish thing, you know, where there's a lot of organic growth. You see a lot of sponsors. Like, I can remember 2 or 3 years ago when we looked at the sponsor list, it was decent. It was okay, but, you know, made sense for that, for an Embassy Suites in Omaha and whatever. Let me tell you, this year I was actually kind of floored. Did you look at the sponsor list, Seth?
Oh yeah, yeah. And I wandered the, because I was there during, like, when the sponsors were there. It did feel like there was quite a row of sponsors. There's a lot more people interested in it, a lot more people showing up, and a lot more sponsors, which is great from a, you know, community growth perspective. It's gonna continue to get bigger, basically.
Well, it was incredible. I mean, I think that allowed for, yeah, better space, better everything in general. So them attracting those sponsors, it was very evident to me that that money was put directly into making the best conference possible. You know, I think everything from the way that it was very easy. Everything's very easy, I felt like. And you'll have to, because I'm just talking about the training days, you'll have to actually fill the audience in on the conference days, but I felt that the check-in process, that granted a very small group, but everything from the check-in process to Wi-Fi to everything was just food, you know, the coordination and communication, the swag store was incredible. Like, just everything was really, had really, really leveled up a lot. And so this year was just really, really polished. And I felt like this year got the benefit of all the previous years. Yeah. The students were awesome. They were really engaged. The space was great for us to train in. I felt like they were super ultra accommodating, checked in a lot on us. Everything was professionally done. I really had no complaints and really was just grateful for them running such a great conference. But now, that was those were the training days. So like that would have been Tuesday, Wednesday, Monday, Tuesday, something like that. So then how did on the conference days, how did it go for you?
So the conference was great, right? Like the badge was super cool, right? Like the theme this year was off the grid or something like that. So it had like a little wind up component to it. Badge challenge was very well done. I didn't make it all the way through, right? Because I was attending talks and talking to people and then having to work, right? Like that was, that's always the hard thing, again, running a business, right? Like you can't completely separate and just attend a conference anymore. It actually felt like a little bit of a palate cleanser for me from a talk perspective, because it wasn't only AI, right? So think about B-Side San Francisco, and every single talk was all in on LLMs and AI components and how that, you know, and Mythos, right? We're going to get into Mythos here in a bit, I'm sure, right? But it harkened back to like real security stuff and not just AI, or not just using AI to do security things, but the complexities of authentication, network controls, like there was mobile stuff. I mean, there was a couple of talks that were AI focused or using AI to do network pen or whatever it is, like, but it wasn't the whole conference. which is something that I'm starting to appreciate more and more, because we still have all these problems, right? We still have the Crocs and socks of security. And we're ignoring that because we think AI is this panacea, or the larger industry, not we, like as in me and Ken, but the larger industry is focused on using AI to do all of these things, not realizing that there are still deterministic checks and things that we've been doing for years that are still valid. And there are research topics that need to be explored within those. And maybe you can use AI to help enhance your research, but those are still hard problems to solve from a organizational level to, I mean, obviously authentication for Slack is something that's broken right now. They're not authenticating people in a proper manner, and we're seeing social engineering attacks because it's not there. So like all of these aspects still come into play. And so it did feel like a palate cleanser for me that I was able to attend talks, and it wasn't only about Mythos. It wasn't only about Opus and Claude and, you know, OpenAI, especially after RSA, where that's the only thing that anyone wanted to talk about. So that was great. I mean, well organized. It does feel like the villages have expanded a fair bit. There's more villages, you know, they were trying to get people out to touch grass a little bit and actually get hands-on, more maker style in some of the village areas, which was pretty awesome, right? Like, you know, we do need that aspect of hacking things as not only using technology to hack, it's actually understanding how things are put together and then able to pull that apart. I mean, there's a reason that the lockpick village is at most conferences, because it does force us as security professionals to think about the controls that we have in place from a different viewpoint. Anyway, like that was pretty cool. It's not the largest conference, right? Like it is in Omaha. I think I don't know what the final attendee count was, to be honest, but it felt probably, again, like you were saying, a good 100 or so more than it was the last time that we attended. So we're looking at probably 700, 800, maybe 1,000 at this point. But the number of sponsors was pretty effective, and everybody was, you know, super friendly. It's a good conference to go to if you've never been.
Hey, I want to dial in on something you said, actually, which I really have been feeling this. And obviously, everybody knows what I do, so it's going to be weird for me to say this. But yeah, I actually agree with you, because I think we've got a little... Okay, and we're the worst offenders of it. I get that. But I do think, like, as an industry, we've forgotten that we focus so much on, like, the Silicon Valley world that we've lost sight of the fact that there is, like, 95% of folks who are still, like, they're still dealing with the regular old stuff we've always dealt with. Nothing's really changed in their ecosystem, in their sphere. Yes, there's big changes on the horizon. Yes, there's things in the bleeding edge spots. And, you know, those that live in those communities and those echo chambers are, you know, range in their perception ranges from, you know, we're basically all going to be slaves to machines in a year from now, or to like, you know, pretty much every business is dead and frontier models will just eat them all, to whatever, right? Like there's a lot of like fear and uncertainty and doubt out there. And there's hope too, whatever. My point is there's lots of thoughts and theories and this, that, and the other, but the truth is like the rest of the world is still moving on the way it always moved on. And we forget about that. And it's nice to see, just to say, kind of add to what you're saying, it's nice to see a little bit more focus on the good old fundamentals, the good old fashion, like, no, these problems still exist. They weren't solved overnight. As much hype and as much whatever as we all still have our day jobs that we have to go do a regular old stuff on. And that hasn't really changed. And sure, for some people it has. And definitely if you're in California and the North California part, I guess. Sorry, that's a little joke about North and South. But anyways, yeah, sure. It's probably moving the needle for you significantly, but not everybody, right? So anyways, I guess I just agree with you. It's nice to see like a bit of a focus on the old fundamentals, because there's still value in that. And I think, yeah, we'll talk about Mythos and all that, but Yeah, and let's get into it. Let's talk about Mythos. Screw it. I mean,
okay.
Where do you want to start with that?
Hold on. We're going to start at the beginning. We're going to start at, so there was the leak, right? Whatever it is.
I'm just putting this up on screen because I love this. What Bobby said, just explaining that, why that's on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. Bobby's response was basically that he would love to see more stuff where you fix things, because most newbies in our industry break things, but don't hear a lot about fixing things and cool stuff there. He's right. We don't, like, we have a tendency to overplay an exploit, not an actual fix or a mitigation. All right. So let's talk about Mythos. I don't know. I mean, has anybody, contacted you to ask your opinion on Mythos?
I mean, you can imagine everybody. Like, basically, what happens every time something comes out that might threaten, people think, like, maybe, like, threatens my business or whatever, they just, like, send me a link. Like, what do you think? It's like, all right, what do you think, you know? So here's what I'll say about Mythos. Like, I don't think it's going to take... Well, I guess we should just start from the beginning, right, with Mythos. So there was, you know, a leak, quote unquote leak, whether you believe that or not, it's up to you, but quote unquote leak of new capabilities. I think there were some things that maybe weren't talked about. And I'm going to just give credit to Pete, who actually recognized this on our team and mentioned it, was that like, if you look at Replit and Lovable, it looks like Anthropic's basically trying to eat up their business as well. Some people have said to that end that, you know, these frontier models are basically like the Borg, right? Where they get to watch your business case. They get to let you go through all the pain of figuring out product market fit. And then if you're viable, boom, cool. You're a cool business case that we can steal because you backed your thing by us, which is something to be careful of with these frontier models. But in any case, they leaked that they are... They leaked this really super, super capable model, plus a lot of other features that are eating other businesses and all this kind of stuff. The market reactions vary quite widely, which I think we should talk about and get into. But the basic premise is they had these model cards and they kind of said, well, we work with these 20 organizations and we have this model that's just way too dangerous to release. And if you look at the model cards, it's... basically the scariest thing ever. And we generated, found, you know, thousands of bugs in existing software and this, that, and the other. And so, like, their newest, most capable cyber security model that some people have different reactions on, which we'll, again, get into. But the idea being that it could be very capable from both an offensive and defensive standpoint. And then the benchmarks are a little weird. And we'll get into that, but I'd like to just talk to other people's opinions. I'm happy to give mine, of course, but I think it's better to just walk through so. But I am curious, Seth, before we get into anybody else's opinions, what are your thoughts here? What are you thinking here with this model?
So I've been pretty pessimistic on most of these responses or most of these previews that have come out of Anthropic. Mainly due to the business use case behind it, right? They are financially driven to push more and more people to use their LLMs and their models to perform any task. They have investor pressure to prove that they're the best. And so it's really hard, even though we know that these models are good at identifying security things, it's really hard to take it without a grain of salt and take it at release level, I guess I should say, that the only thing that they're better than the other models that are out there, number one, but also that there isn't a financial incentive to them actually releasing these as if it's almost marketing material to push people one direction or another. I feel like they make more money the more that they're in the news. And so it goes back to the old adage in marketing that, you know, any news is good news, right? Like, you know, your name being mentioned means you're going to make more money. And so, yeah, I go back and forth. I mean, you and I both know how hard it is to instrument these models to actually do something like this. The amount of effort that actually went into instrumenting Mythos to perform this, yes, there's thinking that goes into it, but there's agents. There's a number of tokens that got burned to do this. Like, they don't necessarily mention the cost that went into it to actually put something like this out. And then actually to create a pipeline, whether that's deep agents or whatever it is, to actually go and identify these things, exploit these things, and then not to come out with actual specifics feels pretty shady to me. That's where I kind of draw the line, is I'm like, hey guys, like, even if you're holding the model in reserve because it is too dangerous, right? Like, sorry, I'm rolling my eyes over here, but even if it is, you know, you're holding it as in reserve because it is too dangerous, you can at least give out specifics on what was identified, where it actually went, what the, you know, what the thinking process was, what it actually looked like. So that it could be verified by experts that weren't your hand-chosen experts, right? And so that's where I start to get very pessimistic on what this release actually means. And it did feel like a lot of the responses I had or I saw from other people in the industry was very similar, right? Like other Slacks that I'm in, everybody's like, really? We're doing this again, right? Like after the, you know, you came out with Slash security code review or whatever it was, right? Like now you're saying that you're the best pen testing agent that's out there and you're identifying vulnerabilities in all of these different things, which you may very well be, but you're not pulling back the covers enough for us to trust you. I think that's where I'm falling on it.
Well, I don't think you're alone. Yeah, I don't think you're alone. It is weird, though, like that as the thing, though, too, is that it depends on the segment group that you talk to. If you talk to like technicians, if you talk to people that actually understand what's going on with these machines and how they work and have built tooling around it and actually because remember, at this point, we actually have people now that have spent decent amounts of time building products and not just like products that you sell. You know, these are internal products as well. It's build buy kind of thing. So you build these products internally or for other people externally, but you build it and you get a sense of their limitations very, very quickly. I think it doesn't take longer than say usually about 4 weeks. I mean, it could be like 4 hours, honestly, it just depends. But if you get something that kind of somewhat consistently works, you do notice degradation after not just degradation, but actually like a lot of cracks in the, I don't think it takes 4 weeks, but I mean, it can take up to 4 weeks to see those cracks is my point. That's what I've noticed with most people. So why am I saying that? Well, I think if you don't have a true understanding of the ecosystem, it's hard for you to form opinions more than just what you've read. If you haven't done that. So that segment very much is in line with what you're saying, Seth. Like that's, I'm seeing, and during, in that segment, I'm seeing questions about the benchmark, about the limited use. Are they like tuning for their evaluation? Also the fact that like, it doesn't necessarily matter, right? It does matter that your LLM's performant, but these things, to do the things they have to do long running agentic tasks. And that actually takes like quite a bit of work because as you know, like actually I was just reading an article that Ramp put out about this, their way of solving long running agentic tasks through context, essentially choosing what context makes the most sense. And you see this over and over and over again. You see all these articles about ways that people are getting around problems that they're seeing with the various LLMs they're using. That hasn't changed, right? So I can throw a single shot at a very, very capable model and I might get something pretty good. But again, like over time and through different use cases and different uses in the general, then it's like, okay, well, how am I evaluating how these are working? How am I correcting when they're not? And that's when the real spend, both engineering time and money, kind of starts to show up. I'm really hitting home this part because I feel like that segment understands technical limitations, understands cost, understands all the things, right? Then there's, and for them, it's mostly sort of meh, whatever. But then there's a problem, because there's a huge disconnect between the type of people that watch this podcast and have, as I would argue, are part of that segment versus the other segments. And so if we look at, for instance, CISOs, I just saw a report yesterday. It was 52% of CISOs believe that were polled in this survey believe that frontier models will own all security, all of security, not will become your SaaS provider or your DAS provider or your, I don't know, whatever it is. They will just own security outright. That will belong to them. That's terrifying. But in any case, that's what 52% of CISOs polled believe. Okay, and that's where it gets really scary, because somebody out there, a lot of people actually believe that these LLM providers are going to be the panacea to all security, software security problems. I don't even know what to say with that. I'm like, I honestly wouldn't even know where to begin. It's like, you ever heard an argument so ridiculous, you're like, how do I even begin to like go at that problem? But, you know, frankly, that's not why I'm bringing it up. I'm just letting you know that's where CISOs are at. I'll try to find that report because I do have it in Slack. So during this podcast, I will do my very best to find that. It's a pretty interesting read, a little terrifying for where leaders think we're going. But in any case, that's what they believe. Then there is the other, there are the other folks that do matter, you know, fairly equally here. Because you have to remember, if your investment wing of any industry does not believe in that industry's ability to eat up a certain amount of money in the market, then they stop investing. And if they stop investing, well, you just killed off essentially innovation. So I would argue that every time that Anthropic or OpenAI does this kind of marketing show pony stuff, what happens is that they actually do a good job of killing off innovation in the space while maintaining their sort of, you know, piece to that. And again, you're right. I think they hurt the stock market. They hurt investors, or sorry, they hurt innovators. And we kind of all just right now are just dealing with, well, that's going to be the way it is until there's an answer for that. And until there is an answer for that. And that's why I'm really saying, like, we can all know that this is ridiculous, but until the CISO market and the investor market and basically anybody in the sport coat and Patagonia vest world comes to their senses or can see a future where that's not the reality, we are all in for a really tough time. And I mean that, like, I think this is backing off, but I had even heard of CISOs and C-suites letting go of security people because they believe LLMs will replace human beings. And I hope that trend does not continue. That's terrifying. So I'll just bluntly say it. I'm stuck in the middle of all this as somebody who built a product that has many, well, really it's many different products, to be frank, but anyways, it's a product and it does many different things and it's backed by many, many different LLMs, purpose-built, some we train, some are just small open source ones we use, some are more performant, occasionally a frontier model for maybe some more complex task management. It's not necessary. We can use other models, but, you know, build versus buy, right? What's cheaper in the moment? And my whole point is that, you know, it does suck. It does suck in this moment in the sense that, you know, it's actually great in some ways. So some ways as a business owner, it's amazing because I get such great feedback from customers. And really, I know we're delivering quality and all that fun stuff that you build a company to do. Like, I set out to change things, Seth, you know that. And I've done it, at least with the customers I have. But in the meantime, the headwinds in this market are really, really, really tough. And you got to remember, of all the companies, new security companies out there, not all of them have people that have like a podcast that go and do speaking, that have brand visibility, right? So for those folks, I really feel for them right now. That's got to be even tougher than what I've faced up until this moment. And so this is my fully formed, like, Sorry, security community, it's getting rougher and it may get even rougher, but hopefully soon the wave of people that understand the reality, that tranche will surface up to the CISO and above, and those market segments will begin to follow what people with, you know, rationale and experience say. But we'll see. I don't know. How much longer we have here.
Yeah, it's an interesting... It's an interesting market and landscape right now. I mean, I know on the even the third party side, like as a security consulting firm, that we're struggling with it because people are they're so in the weeds trying to figure out what LLMs actually mean for them that it's hard to get a lot of traction with just players in general across the board and get interest and have discussions. Even when we are testing, you know, their AI enhanced products or whatever it is, they're having a hard time seeing the forest through the trees, basically. AI is the big, it's the big tree in the forest right now, and it's the big bad. And so everybody is focused solely on it. And we're not doesn't necessarily understand under the hood how to make it work. Those that are struggling to do it, like you and I and others in the industry, have seen those edge cases, have seen how rough it actually is, and it becomes. Yeah, oh, sorry, I'm getting a random call. So
that's not my audio when that happens. That happens to me. And if I know, but do not disturb. Sorry, that's not the audio.
Just lose.
When you're. See, this is everybody listening, watching. This is exactly what I'm talking about. I literally just said this, Seth. If you can hear me, it'll cut out your audio.
It cut out my audio. Sorry about that. So it goes back to what Bobby's saying there, though, too, right? Like, I feel like we are. We've always wanted this sort of awareness and this sort of tool to actually make us more effective, right? Like all the security tools that we've designed up to this point have been to make us faster at identifying vulnerabilities and being able to exploit. I said this years ago with, my talk at Sputter and robots, security robots, right? Like this is how we're starting to use LLMs, is to identify things quickly so that we can patch them and fix it. Not so we can exploit it. That seems to be the goal of most of the security companies and most of the, the ones that are promoted very heavily right now is they want to prove exploitation, right? And even Mythos, right? Like when it comes down to it, what are they saying? Oh, look at how we were able to chain these five vulnerabilities together and take over the system and exploit FFmpeg or FreeBSD or whatever it is. I'm like, that's great, man, but why didn't you actually just fix those if you were already in there so that it couldn't happen, right? Like I understand you're trying to prove impact, but I always hate this from the security community that the exploit is so much more important than actually going and mitigating vulnerabilities and fixing vulnerabilities and really, fixing flaws.
Oh, no. Wait. I'm sorry. Shay, I was going to say something though. Like you bring up a good point. There's another article I was reading where they proved that the same system writing code shouldn't be the same system reading code. And something you said just now really triggered in on that what did you say? I'm sorry, Seth, I don't mean to interrupt you, but something you said was about, made me think about that. Anyways.
Yeah.
Sorry. All right, please continue. I did interrupt you.
No, you're good. I mean, there's, you know, Bobby saying how like our job has always been to put ourselves out of one, right? We've always tried to automate and to make us more efficient so we could concentrate on harder problems. And we could think about business logic flaws. We could think about actually security architecture. Or we could think about other things that impact or are of greater value to the business. And so we should be utilizing LLMs to do these sorts of things. I'm not against that at all, right? Like in fact, we're using that internally in our own processes in the way that we're assessing applications, and it speeds things up. Your product speeds things up for us from a code review perspective. And it's great to see like what's actually being surfaced. There is still an aspect of human in the loop on that. You probably shouldn't be exploiting or evaluating, to your point, code that was written by one LLM with that same LLM, because you know it's going to tell you that it's great, right? Like that's how we've actually trained these models to respond. And I also am starting to one of the big things that I've been coming around on, and I think you have as well, is the use of small language models as opposed to large language models. I don't think we need, in general, I don't think we need general frontier models to do everything that's out there, right? Like from a cost perspective, I think we're just burning energy and money and tokens to accomplish tasks which could be accomplished by something that was very well trained and specific. The fact that you know we have memory crunch issues, that we have power issues to run these frontier models, feels like a pretty big waste to me, considering most of the time we're asking very limited questions. We don't need general intelligence. This is an example, right? Like recently on a Zoom call, and I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast. I know I did in training, right? Like, but I'm on a Zoom call. There's a new AI assistant that's backed by an LLM that's there that it does RAG with the current call and the transcript that's going on. So you can ask questions of the LLM. It's like a chatbot built into Zoom. I got totally distracted in this Zoom call for other reasons. Because I started having that LLM inside of Zoom, mind you, actually program things for me and was spitting out code in Python and Golang and Java and questioning why I need the capability inside of Zoom to be able to understand and generate code. Why? Just because it's available inside of this frontier model and just because it's been trained on that, it can actually respond with it. Now, you know, there may be some use cases where this would be important, but I'm just questioning why we're using them for everything, right?
I actually question, because there's some back and forth in the chat about SLMs versus LLMs. And this really does matter for this conversation, because I think there's also this belief, this is the weird thing too, is like, there's also this weird belief from folks at Anthropic or OpenAI, those big beefy LLMs are like, I don't know, somehow better than just everything. And the reality is that, I don't know if anyone's been paying attention, but open source LLMs are getting about as good as they are. And Pete from our team just uncovered one yesterday. Gosh, I have the names. And by the way, let me finish that thought. It's 5.1 something. I forget what it is. Just came out. Looks just as performant, if not for our cases, maybe even better than the frontier models. When we talk about the economics, I'd be shaking in my boots if I was the frontier models watching open source models keep up with us. Because like the whole vendor lock-in and them stealing business cases, you're basically incentivized to run your own LLMs and SLMs. And SLMs are amazing too. As purpose-built SLMs for which is mostly what you should be doing in a lot of cases with LLMs, are like discrete kind of focused tasks. We've talked about that in our course a bunch. It's how you get the best results. So when you fine tune an SLM, an open source SLM towards a specific thing. And Dryrun, we actually put out a blog post. You can go to our blog about this, about how we find why and how we fine tune our and train our classifier model. So if you're interested in like taking pull request feedback from a developer and having it improve like follow on runs, that's what the blog article is about. But for our case, I mean, SLMs are really, really sick. And when you also like can tune open source LLMs, like I frankly went and I asked our team, like, what's it going to cost us to move off of, like, what's needed? And can we just move off these all together? And what's it going to cost? It's like, yeah, we'll actually get better performance. And the cost is not a inference-based cost, it's a steady state cost. So for us, it's even better. So like, just saying this out loud for like a, if anyone's curious, for a company that purely is does everything AI native, and we do all the things, we do PR stuff, we do full repo scans, we do, but we also do code intelligence, because the thing is like, if you're being attacked by these LLMs, you need to move into a world where everything's autonomous. And so that's the substrate layer that we work on. And just to say that out loud, like, we can't really, this part I'll just hold to my chest and tell you when I've done it, but I'm pushing back and trying to get rid of all frontier models is what I'll try to say. I just don't, like, we don't use them that much anyways anymore. And frankly, we're finding, so I guess I'm saying that to be like, well, where does that leave those frontier companies? Like, if I know everyone's really afraid of Mythos and all that, but like, it's okay. It's pretty good. You got to do a lot of stuff to, like, you know, around that type of an LLM. It's just another kind of part of a brain, engine of a brain. What do you think? Like business-wise, how does that, because you're looking at the economics, they've taken even more money. I mean, they're just taking money and money. And I'm just like, where does this lead to? You know, I really am.
Well, and yeah, what I'm seeing, right, like, especially as a small business is trying to build something like this, right, like, to help us, is that I can't, the frontier models, right, like, they may be super great at, like, some of the planning tasks and other things. And I know we've always talked about using the right model for the task at hand, but even some of those reasoning models are so expensive that I can't justify, you know, sending something at them and spending $2,000 or $3,000 a month to answer questions and build out tasks when I can, when it's something that I can plan ahead on and just basically build out and use a small model to do, like, the very, very specific tasks and some of the reasoning that I need that's in there, I can't justify it, right? I cannot justify the cost because it, you know, it just hurts my bottom line. I don't have that flexibility, and I don't have $10 million in AI research that I'm just throwing at this like some of the other companies. That was one of the things that I did notice about the security tooling that was being that's being built, is they will just go out and use Opus to do everything, or Sonnet 4.6. And I'm like, yeah, this might work for your little research project, but you just burn $2,000 to $3,000 on a small research project. And when you get up against a really large code base, you get up against a really large application instance, whatever it is, you're feeding in all these results from, you know, network scanning or whatever it is, guess what? This is not going to scale. And from a financial perspective, you're just going to hurt yourself and your company. You know, somebody was laughing about, oh, well, you know, I sent my CEO a $10,000 bill for doing this research. I'm like, that's a non-significant amount of money to a small company. And
yeah. Yeah, especially when you have margins, you know? Like,
yeah.
You spend on, although I guess R&D isn't part of your margins, but yeah, still not good.
Yeah, I mean, but at the end of the day, it does hit your bottom line, right? Like, if, as long as you're, you know, planning for that from a budget perspective, great. But yeah.
I'm just always thinking about tax. And but jokes aside, though, it's like the economics of it really do. I do really ponder the economics. I'm like, seriously, we won't need these folks forever. This will become commoditized, and it kind of already is with open source models getting fairly far along the way. And if you need to give them a little extra love through some tuning, it's not hard anymore. That's the other problem for these models, is that it's not just that, like, open source models are getting better. It's getting, just generally speaking, much, much, like, easier to train and tune. And I say train and tune because obviously there are two different things. You know, tuning is just taking an existing, like, training's a, could be a bear. It is a bear. There's a reason that these companies, like, make a lot of money, but, or, you know, build these, anyway, whatever, specialize in this thing. But the point is that that the barrier to entry on that has really, really gotten low, and it used to be really, really, really high. So you got to wonder, like, if it gets easier and easier. And I just met with a company yesterday who their whole goal is so that you can in real time train your SLMs or your LLMs, or tune them in real time based off of real world conditions where things get corrected, synthetic data created, and then boom, in real time, while still running, tuned. I was like, very aspirational. I get that, but like, that's where things go. So I guess I'm just trying to say, like, when you can give these tools to everybody to just do themselves for their own reasons, like, you know, do I need you, Anthropic? Do I need you, OpenAI? I think not. I think you're not that interesting anymore. And so what happens to them when they get commoditized?
Yeah. Well, and I think this goes back to what we were talking about with Mythos and the preview and them trying to be in the room for all these discussions so that they get subscribers, because they can see that coming, right? Like, they know that they've got a limited window to get everybody on board and become the Uber, right? Or the Lyft of the AI industry. Because if they don't, what's going to happen? People are going to migrate to SLMs. People are going to migrate to open source models because, yeah, I mean, I'm probably a pretty good use case or model of this. I'm using more and more open source models because they're cheaper, and I can plan around what the cost is actually going to be. Yeah, they definitely forecast this, right? Ray, Ray? Yeah, and that's what I'm going to do over time, because I just can't afford it anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I don't know how to put a bow on any of this today, Ben. I really don't.
I think it's pretty. I think I'll tell you what, I'll do the bow thing. I think it's just pretty much like, you know, it's a weird time, but like, we have to sort of, unfortunately, like, I just think that we sort of have to wait for the intense echo chamber without substance to die down in certain market segments, because as much as practitioners, in my opinion, rule the world, we always have to convince the C-suite, you know, of what we need and what's the right thing to do. And the C-suite, that what they decide ends up choosing sort of what, you know, the rest of the market, the finance folks, see. So I think, like, put it this way, if you're watching the podcast, I don't think that you need, because I know people are concerned about their jobs, they're worried Mythos is going to take their job and all that kind of stuff. I don't think you need to worry about that, like, at all. Let me just say that outright. I think what you will need to worry about is figuring out how to get ahead of reduction in workforce, reduction in workforces, budget slashing, and start to tell a story to your C-suite, or at least have some answers. Put it this way, just have a plan. Just have some answers in case this scenario comes up, because it will. It probably will come up at some point. If not now, at some point in the near future, it will come up, and you'll have to have an answer for it. And there's lots of good answers for it, but that question is going to come up. So I don't know. Just build a plan, be ready for it, and try to survive the next little bit while people. We try to wait for them to get their heads screwed on correctly again.
Yeah. Yep. It does feel like, I mean, from my perspective, there's a lot of hunkering down, like the other, like on the consulting side of things, like people are trying to make do, figure out where, you know, where people need help, how we can be the advisors that we've always been. And, you know, it's changing a little bit for sure. Right. There's a lot more discussion on AI, obviously. Tomcat goes burr, like his comment on you guys used a, you know, we broadcast a live stream session coding using GitHub Copilot when that was hot, right? He's right, we did, yeah. Right? Like we utilize these tools. Like I know Ken does, like I use Claude Code, right? Like I'll be honest. I've used Codex in the past, I've used Copilot, like you know, I still like my AI spend is way more than I realistically want it to be. Because I'm trying to figure out where to go and how to utilize it best, and how to make my guys more efficient as they're doing assessment work. So, yeah.
I don't know, though, we did have a bit of a, I was like on the team that secured the GitHub Copilot rollout. So I did have a little bit of a heads up. This is all coming, I guess. So That's true. But yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty easy to see where things are going. It's just, frankly, it's just a patience thing, I feel like, and have a plan for how to discuss this with people. Because again, I get sent stuff, I'm sure you do too, all the time, where people are like, what do you think? And I, you know, thanks, but you know, where you, it's always a question like, where is this really coming from? I kind of think I know where it comes from. And it's sort of like, I naturally always have to have a response for these types of situations. And I think everybody else should now too, is my point, is like, they now need to as well, because now you're dealing with, where for me, it was product related. Now it's everybody else. It's like personnel. And well, I hate to say this, I have a lot of fear with people, but I did come across a few reduction in workforces in the last few months with people I was talking to in the middle of POCs. And I'm like, oh my God, this is really not fun to watch. And, you know, I got the reasons I was telling you, where people are like, yeah, it's like, I don't need these employees if like I can throw stuff at a model and they'll just do everything. It's like, oh God. Or worse, the worst one I heard was, well, you don't need AppSec if these models, if you're using Claude Code. I've actually heard this, like, you don't need it because like Claude Code's just writing secure code out of the box. You know, Codex is writing out of the box, right? Like, they just know what they're doing. Like, those will just be, I mean, yeah, once in a while a bug here and there, but like in 6 months it'll be perfect. So what do we need you all for? I'm like, oh God. To your question, Tomcat, Tomcat goes Burr, models will definitely get cheaper in the future. At least for open source hosting, training, tuning. Frontier models, I don't know what they're going to do, frankly. I don't have any thoughts on it because their businesses are dubious at best. And then the risks that it's exposing, and this is the one thing I think I would call out with risks that Mythos is exposing, is just that. And it's not just Mythos, because I could care less about Mythos specifically. Just LLMs in general getting better at cyber security capabilities just means that we have to go more autonomous with how we secure things. Why am I saying that? Because I'm saying like there's a few thoughts that went through my head in that moment, but one of them was like, if we can wake up at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. and see that overnight, an agent came in, impersonated one of us, distributed malware, used that to further a campaign, whatever. It's like, well, yeah, I have to have my own automated, like, autonomous system to deal with those types of attacks and detect those types of things and defend them, just as an example. So that's what the risks is just faster time to exploitation. So we have faster hands-off ways of securing ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, but we've always done this, right? Like, this is what you're describing as a firewall. So now we just have, you know, an agent that runs, that's watching for threats and trying to correlate what's actually there. The flexibility, the creativity is what's going to drive this next, this next period of time. It's an arms race. Right, it is an actual arms race as to who's going to be successful. We're going to see more attacks. You already, like, already, if you go and watch like our NetSec or CVEs or, you know, any sort of like vulnerability list or exploit list that's out there, you are seeing a rapid increase in the number of reports. You're seeing a rapid increase in the number of vulnerabilities, the number of CVEs that are being generated because people are utilizing these tools. So you're going to see those turned into actual exploits. We've got to get better at basically patching and mitigation strategies and how we're actually utilizing LLMs to do that. Anyway. We've been going for over an hour, Ken. Defense in depth has and will continue to hold, right? That goes back to basics. Crocs and socks. Crocs and socks, baby. Yes. It is the way.
It is going to hold up. I don't know. Maybe, but so do humans. But I think it would just be faster. I don't think AI is doing things differently. I think it's just faster and faster. So you can iterate over tax services quicker. So yeah, I agree with Ray Ray. It's, so like, yeah, I think both are true, but I don't think it's a bad thing to expose, which is not a bad thing to expose, crux is, expose all the bones. Yeah, I think, but that's why I'm saying, like, I think autonomous defense is going to be the key, because they're just going to be finding things faster than any of us can keep up. So gotta find ways to answer.
Crocs and socks. There's a new t-shirt coming for sure.
Defense in depth, autonomous actions, defense in depth. Yes, I think it's all so cool, man. All
tied together. Okay. Thank you for the activity today and interacting during the podcast, everybody that's on the YouTube channel and in Slack. We will get into more of this. Jump into Slack. If you don't have an invite, please reach out to Ken or I. At absoluteappsec.com, right? Just email and we'll send you an invite link for now. And yeah, otherwise, keep your head up, keep grinding. We're going to get through this period. We always do. Just means the landscape's going to change a little bit, but appreciate y'all and keep it up.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Ciao.